from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Celebrating Mother Angelica with her spiritual sons and daughters. On Register Radio this week, Jeanette DeMello and Register writer Joseph Pronishin talk about the flood of remembrances pouring in. Also, Jeanette and Register writer Peter Jesserer Smith explore new ways that parishes are using to keep new Easter Catholic converts engaged in the faith. Welcome to Register Radio, a co-production of EWTN and the National Catholic Register. I'm the producer of the show, Elena Rodriguez, sitting in this week for Tom Price. Our editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register, Jeanette DeMello, will be leading the conversations. Thank you for joining us, Jeanette. Our first guest is Joseph Pronishin, staff writer with the National Catholic Register since 2005. His articles have appeared regularly in a number of national publications, including Columbia Magazine, Faith and Family, Catholic Digest, and Marian Helper. Joseph was blessed to attend Mother Angelica's massive Christian burial and rite of committal in the Shrine of the Most Blessed Sacrament in Hanceville, Alabama, and he is here to share his first-person account. Jeanette?
Joe, you were at the shrine last week. You were able to bring to our readers the events surrounding Mother Angelica's funeral, something all of the Register staff wishes we could have been doing. We could have been there with you, but you had that privilege, and we're grateful for all the coverage that you did. And really, I want to know from first, a very personal point of view, what were the highlights of your time there at the Shrine of the Blessed Sacrament in Hanceville?
There were so many highlights, Jen, and I want to thank you, by the way, for the opportunity to be there and cover the events. It was just, you knew you were in the presence of a saintly person. We all wanted to say saint. We didn't say saintly, we said saint, because it was just an extremely special aura, if we can say, about it. There was such peace. There was such calmness. And I talked to Father Apostoli just today, in fact, and he said, once again, and he was there, was one of the concelebrants, and he says, you know, at a time like this, it's normally a time of mourning, and yet this went beyond that because it was a sense of peace and joy you'd have. And some of the other highlights were the funeral mass itself. It was raised to celestial heights, just about, and to be there in the temple, as Mother called it, where her funeral was, and to meet so many wonderful people who had a couple of people I did not meet that one of the other EWTN workers mentioned, but they drove all the way from Oklahoma. Wow. Nonstop. To pay their respects at the visitation, and they had to hop in their car and drive immediately back so that they take work. But, I mean, that's the kind of people you would run into, that their lives were so touched over the years by Mother Angelica. You know, I could share some of those stories later with you.
Sure, sure. You know, there were, and it's estimated there were 2,000 people there at the funeral, and of course, there were so many more people who were able to be present in the way that we have been present with Mother Angelica for so long, and that is through her broadcasts. And EWTN broadcast this, and I was able to watch from my computer through a live stream, and that was the way that I was present during those moments. And the mass of the funeral was truly just, like you said, celestial. It was a beautiful, beautiful liturgy. And,
yeah.
You know,
oh, yeah.
Joe, you wrote a story, and we actually wrote it before Mother Angelica had died, and it was to tell the story of her legacy, and part of that legacy is her sisters is told through the mouths of her spiritual daughters. She was a foundress of the monastery, and that's a very important role. You interviewed a few sisters for that story. What did they have to say about their spiritual mother?
Oh, the wonderful things. Mother Dolores, who is now mother of the sisters, and who never thought, as you mentioned in the article, that she would be entering the monastery until she came to work there. But first of all, I do want to say she has that same sense of dedication, that same sense of joy, certainly rubbed off on her for Mother Angelica, and so uplifting is. And she said that, you know, some of the things that that she recounted, that Mother Angelica had this great trust, and that was a constant influence on them, and it was almost like Mother Dolores. It was almost like a crazy sense of trust, even with the satellite dish at the beginning. She ordered, where she didn't have the money to pay for it, and the Lord provided at the last minute. And if I can recall correctly, she didn't give me the details, but if I can recall correctly, the Lord provided that day. They were dropping off the satellite dish and wouldn't take it off the truck unless they got paid. And all of a sudden, they get a phone call with this person out of the blue that decided to donate X amount of money to the network, and it was the exact amount needed for that. So that really struck Mother Dolores, those kind of things. And she says it always came through. The astronomical costs for the network, as the network grew, became more and more, and yet it always came through, and Mother never wavered, never doubted, because she said it was Jesus' work that she was doing, and he wasn't going to fail her. And certainly we saw that over and over again. And I like what Sister Mary Michael said, too, and Father Joseph alluded to that in his homily, too. I guess he had heard it, too, obviously. There was a chuckle over it because she said that Mother every once in a while used her yelling theology when she needed to get somebody's attention and they just weren't listening.
That's right. I mean, every mother does that every now and then.
Yes, yeah. So. But she said she always leave you knowing you were loved and feeling warm about it at that correction, because she put the warmth of her hand on her shoulder would tell you that she was right there with you and standing with you and not letting you go, you know?
Absolutely. You know, you just said, told a little part of a story that reminded me of another story that we've been covering this week. And you mentioned Mother Dolores just talking about this great trust that Mother Angelica had, that when God gave her an idea, it was his plan, he would provide. And you know, we wrote a story, it was written by Brian Fraga, another Register writer, about Mother Angelica's impact on media people today, just how much of a media giant she was. And we talked to Bishop Barron, Robert Barron, for that, and he said that was one of the things that influenced him most in about Mother Angelica was that just great trust that she had as she started off all of these apostolates related to her monastery. So that really spoke volumes to many people, was that great trust that she had. This is Jeanette DeMello on Register Radio. I'm speaking to Joseph Pronishin. He is a staff writer at the Register, and we're talking about his time in Hanceville during the funeral and events last week after Mother Angelica died. Now, Joe, you also wrote about people who Mother Angelica touched in special ways, in ways that that caused them to do things in life that they probably would have never thought to do before, having met her in some way or other. One of those things was people who moved to the shrine, to Hanceville, the small town in Alabama, just to be near her. Mm-hmm. Tell us about these wonderful stories of the ways Mother was always a mother to many people.
I spoke to a couple of the women that had moved to Hanceville, and the interesting thing is that in just about every single case, none of them planned to move to Hanceville, and at first when that opportunity presented itself or they had the thought, they practically, you know, joked about it, laughed about Hanceville. No, we're just staying put where we are. It was a gentleman who... and his wife, who met Mother Angelica in Chicago when she had visited there many, many years ago. And she mentioned moved to Hanceville. They said, yeah, Chicago's our home. But they wound up moving to Hanceville, and he wound up, he did a lot of cooking on the side, so he'd cook her some of her favorite meals. They moved pretty close because he says they bought a piece of land on one of their visits. They just visited a lot, and on County Road 747. And he woke up one morning, and they looked at the clock, and he says, gee, it says 7:47. And he says, I wonder what that's supposed to mean to his wife. And his wife says, I think that means we have to move to Hanceville, which they did. And he moved around the corner from the shrine. And one of the women who works in the shrine, same thing. They They were in Boca Raton, Florida, and decided to move up, and they said it turned out to be a sheer gift. And the woman said, I was praying for 30 years for my husband to become a Catholic because he was Protestant. And she said, here we move up. He gets a job with the nuns, and he was non-Catholic. He had no intention of moving up, but for some reason he decided, you know, well, let's move up. And 2 months after the nuns start praying for him, he wanted to join our CIA class.
Wow.
And then I met another lovely woman with her four children, young children. The oldest was about 8, and I mentioned this in one of the articles. And they were just such a lovely family. The children were in their Sunday best, all so cute, you know. And she said that it was Mother Angelica who, and her grandmother who brought her back to the church, because as a child, she used to pray the rosary with her grandmother and Mother Angelica.
That's
right. They all, three of them together, so to speak. And then as a teen, she left the church looking for a different church. And she says what it was it came, after her, it was the rosary with Mother Angelica and her grandmother that brought her back to the faith. And
that's
now
right.
She and her little children pray the rosary every, every second day, because they alternate it with the Divine Mercy Chaplet, which Mother Angelica also began. I believe she was the first to have the Divine Mercy Chaplet televised, and that was back in the late 80s. And she started talking about that devotion back in 85. She had Father George Kosicki on the show. So it's just amazing how many people, and you run across stories like that, one after the other, you know. And
I'm so glad you were able to recount so many of these stories. Many of them will be in our April 17th issue, special edition of the Register, that has a tribute to Mother Angelica. And Joe, we just have a very short amount of time left mm-hmm. on this show. And I wanted to ask you specifically about the funeral. When you were in the temple, as Mother Angelica called mm-hmm. the shrine, what struck you at that time?
The incredible reverence, number one, of the Mass. Not that, you know, sometimes, to be honest, I've been in a Mass where it's been hurried or quick or something. Not that the priest was going to be irreverent, but this one had that special super reverence to it that just uplifted everything with it's something I'm sure Mother was smiling at must have, because she was so devoted to the Eucharist, so devoted to the liturgy. It was celebrated ad orientem. It was celebrated, which they do at the shrine, and it was celebrated, and people would kneel at the communion rail for communion, and they had communion standing communion stations too. So, you know, but the music was heavenly. The Scola from St. John Cantius in Chicago, everything was just, you know, several notches above, and you could see, as Father Apostoli told me, that was that special, special presence of God. He's there always at a Mass in the Eucharist, but here there was something that was extra special.
We know, Joe, that presence was something that was always felt by Mother Angelica, and we're so grateful mm-hmm. that she has helped us to learn about that presence more. And thank you so much, Joe, for covering the funeral and all of the events of last week.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome, Jeanette. And thank you for having me on.
And thank you, Joseph Pronishin. And thanks to Jeanette DeMello as well. When we return, many brothers and sisters have joined the Catholic Church this Easter, but how do we encourage one another to keep learning and loving our faith? Register Radio continues in a moment on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
In today's world, we have all kinds of misinformation and even disinformation about Christianity, Catholicism, and religion in general. And we need a source that is going to give us direct quotations and authentic news about what is going on in the church, so we know what the Pope really said and not what the media said he said. We need to know what the Synod is doing, what the encyclicals mean, in order to be able to give the facts of our faith. For that reason, we need the National Catholic Register, which will give us the good news along with the hard news of our world today. And in that way, we can have what we need to go out to our world and give them the good news of Jesus Christ.
For a free 6-issue trial of the National Catholic Register, go to EWTN.com and click on the banner for the Register, or call 800-421-3230 for your 6 free issues.
Making a difference, EWTN Radio.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. Along with Jeanette DeMello, I'm Elena Rodriguez. Our next guest is Peter Jesserer Smith, a staff reporter with the National Catholic Register. He helped cover Pope Francis' historic visit to Jerusalem and the Holy Land in 2014. He is here to talk about what parishes are doing to keep new Easter Catholic converts engaged in the faith. Jeanette?
Peter, great to have you on Register Radio. Thanks for being with us again.
Well, thank you, Jeanette, for having me. Appreciate it.
So you recently wrote a story. It's called How Do We Keep Converts in the Church After the Easter Vigil? And in this story, you explore the a common question that new Catholics have when they reach the end of the RCIA process and they say, hey, what's next? With the people you talk to, how did they describe their experience at the end of RCIA?
Well, I mean, the person I talked to in the story, Kristen Stubaker, she had mentioned how she had this wonderful experience going through RCAA. She formed relationships and friendships, and then she was received into the church. What a joyous occasion! And then all of a sudden, she's wondering, well, what's next? Mm-hmm. And a lot of converts going through RCAA do have that experience of what's next. And in her case, she was really fortunate that she had a sponsor who had committed to, who became her friend and had committed to be with her both as a candidate and as a neophyte, getting her feet wet in the church. And she said this was enormously important because once you're actually a Catholic, there's just a lot of different things to figure out and to navigate. Mm-hmm. So having that support there was really, really key as she discerned what was next in her life as Catholic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, your story kind of explores an interesting concept, I think, that is often discussed amongst people who work for the church, who work for parishes, and who are involved in the work of RCIA, and that is that there's the idea that people, RCIA Catholics, don't stay very long. You know, we lose them. And that, I know that idea's out there. Is it backed up by data?
Well, there's yes and no. And the reason we say that is because a lot of this information is anecdotal. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of what we're hearing from this is based on RCIA coordinators and leaders wondering what's happening to the converts that they've just thought they formed in the faith, and now they don't see them within a year. Mm-hmm. And so that is anecdotal, how much they're losing, for example. So some people say, within a year, I don't see half of the converts that I had going through here. And some even say up to 90%, which is staggering. Now, there is, however, a national snapshot that may indicate something's happening, but what exactly it is, we don't quite know. There are two Pew surveys, one drawing from data from 2007 and another from data in 2014. And what you find is that in the course of 7 years, there were 1 million fewer people identifying themselves as Catholic converts. And that should send off alarm bells.
Mm-hmm.
Because where do 1 million people go?
Right.
The other reason it's concerning is because in that 7 years, the church has said we've added at least 100,000 new converts a year into the church. So you add that to the mix, this indicates that there's some bleed out going on, but what exactly is happening, we have no idea. And I think that was actually the more startling thing to find as a reporter, is that we have no idea.
Sure. Sure. You know, you talk to Mark Gray at the CARA Institute, who does so many studies, but CARA only does what they're asked to do, and it's interesting that, you know, he hasn't really been asked to study that yet. It's
exactly.
Hopeful. It's hopeful that somebody might step up and ask for a study of that, because it could yield some very interesting results. But there may not be data about what is happening to the RCIA Catholics in terms of how long they stay, etc. But there seems to be some interesting, whether it's anecdotal evidence again, or it's actual data about what keeps them in the church. What did you find helps them to stay at home in the Catholic Church?
Well, what I did was I talked to a number of different RCIA directors who were having success, and the consistent theme that I found from them was that truly emphasizing discipleship in truly emphasizing forming disciples in Jesus Christ was the key. If they did not have a personal encounter, make a personal commitment to accept Jesus Christ before they began receiving the teachings of the church, it wasn't going to work. As one of them pointed out to me, you can't become intimate with a person you don't know. If these people don't know Christ, they're not going to be able to become intimate with him. And eventually, they're just going to reject the attempt to give them the teachings of the church. So the areas that they identified really, really needed work were the pre-catechumenate, in which this encounter, the decision to really accept Jesus Christ and to choose to become his disciple has to take place. And their key was, it may take a year, but give them as long as it takes, so that when they're finally ready, they're disposed to accept the teachings of the church and learning about the sacraments, because they see that all these things are aimed at helping them know and become more intimate with Jesus Christ. So that's the first part of it. But the second part is really key as well. And that's after they become received in the church. We need to stress discipleship in a period called mystagogy, which is church's term for a period of study and deepening your faith, which is lifelong, but this has to be accompanied. They have to have their sponsors and godparents still walking with them, showing them how to be disciples of Christ, answering their questions, always being there for them, inviting them to go further, to go deeper. That, they say, when you do both of those things, you get Catholics who are not only staying, but they are active. They are
exciting.
Very active, and they are alive with Jesus Christ. One of them said his program, when they emphasized that, they went from, you know, keeping 40% to retaining 80%. So 8 out of 10 people they prepared. That's a big difference.
Sure. This is Jeanette DeMello on Register Radio, and I'm speaking to Peter Jesserer Smith, who writes for the Register and recently wrote a story about RCIA Catholics and how long they stay in the church and how we might keep them in the church forever. And Peter, this is a very interesting conversation. I've been involved in RCIA for a number of years, helping to teach, and this idea that when you give them an encounter with Jesus, that it's going to help them to work through the teaching and to really embrace the teaching. That's vital. It seems so important.
Yeah.
Are there programs that are doing this? Can you list some of them?
Well, I mean, there are, let's see. Can I list programs, specific programs themselves? A lot of it, I think, depends. Programs are really tools. It really, from the people that I talked to, said you can have the best program or the best materials, but if the RCIA leader is not dedicated to helping people become disciples of Jesus Christ, if the godparents and sponsors don't realize that, aren't trained and realize it's their duty to be disciples of Jesus Christ, and to help this person be a disciple of Jesus Christ, it's not going to work. No programs or training can help you. Now, on the other hand, there are there are a number of very important educational materials that people were drawing upon, especially for the mystagogy period. And St. Timothy's in Mesa, Arizona was an excellent example. They were drawing from Father Robert Barron's Catholicism series. Mm-hmm. The Deacon Jim Beatty, who I talked to over there, he said that, but you have to be flexible. You have to understand what people can respond to. Some people respond to Father Barron's series. Other people do well deepening their faith through the C2 continuing education series that they have. There are a number of different programs. Sherry Waddell's Forming Intentional Disciples gives a lot of good thoughts and the principles that one has. So that's kind of some of the interesting things that are out
there.
Sure.
Well, that's great, Peter. Thanks for bringing this important topic to us. I encourage our listeners to read your story, How Do We Keep Converts in the Church After the Easter Vigil? And hopefully our readers can get involved in these processes, too. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Jeanette.
And thank you both, Peter Jesserer-Smith and Jeanette DeMello. You can read more about the life and legacy of Mother Angelica, as well as what parishes are doing to engage the faith of new Easter Catholic converts by going to ncregister.com. And do you know of anyone who might want to hear Register Radio? Point them to ncregister.com and click on the Radio tab to listen or even to download the show. All Register Radio shows are archived there. On behalf of Jeanette DeMello, Joseph Pronoshen, Peter Jesserer-Smith, Tom Price, and all of us here at The Register and at EWTN Radio, thank you for joining us. This is Elena Rodriguez, and we will be here again next week for more of Register Radio.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.